episode 154 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdern and Barry, part 2.0, I should say. We had a bit of a recording glitch, so we're going to try to recreate some of the magic that we did not get to keep, Barry. And, you know, trust me when I tell you, folks, boy, did you miss out on a great 20-minute segment, because Barry was correct when he said, boy, that's probably the funniest shit we ever did, and then we found out we weren't recording. So we're going to try to recreate some of that magic. We're going to be telling stories about Eight is Enough. We're going to be telling stories about, you know, Lanny O'Grady and Joni Walters, Lori Walters, excuse me, and maybe Adam Rich, too. Barry, how you doing today, my man?
I'll tell you what. I'm ready to go home, Jeff. Let's wrap this up. Let's call this
That's
a show.
It. And we're talking to you next week, folks.
Yeah. Until then.
It's an abbreviated version. It's an abbreviated version of episode 154. So on this week's show, you know, Barry and I, we would like you folks to know that we are just a couple of middle-aged dudes talking. You know, we don't like to think of ourselves as being pigeonholed as wrestling fans, you know, but apparently, here again, I'm raised. Lou, don't do that to me while I'm being in my professional DJ voice. That someone said, oh, I'm sorry, overly excited DJ voice, right, Barry? So we're going to be talking about some of the iTunes reviews we've been getting lately, as we're off to a somewhat staggered start here, Barry.
That really was the funniest 20 minutes, I think, in the history of the show. That except for the three of us, Jeff, Lou, myself, nobody else will ever hear it. But Jeff, these reviews, and you sent me, I think you called me or texted me a couple of weeks back that we had gotten a review. I thought it was really funny. The person wasn't trying to be humorous, but I thought it was humorous. But then we got a review, which looks like it came forth on Saturday. So let's talk about the one on Saturday.
Right after our last episode, sort of coincidentally, you think, Mr. Rose?
There's a couple of things here. So the review is called Bowdren the Blowhard. And Jeff, I didn't write this one, by the way.
Probably one of my ex-wives, because that would be understandable, actually. So, you know.
I try to listen and give the podcast a chance. Barry Rose is very entertaining.
Stop right there, because that is the tip-off to me that you may have written this, because in the history of this program, the only thing entertaining, according to what I have heard on our message board, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdern and Barry, is the Ethiopian shit story. So, you know, that is my legacy,
right there.
When you die in 25 or 30 years, on your headstone, here lies Barry Rose, once ate Ethiopian and shit on a guy's lawn. Someone's going to bring that up, yes.
Gotcha. But Bowdren is so annoying. Bowdren's rants are useless and time-consuming.
So, now let me address this issue.
Sure,
okay.
Please.
Annoying? Probably. Useless? Probably. Time-consuming, I have an issue with. My last rant was maybe a minute and 30 seconds, tops, Barry, when I was talking about the people with 10 listeners or 10 subscribers or whatever. But it was a very short rant. I did have a rant, but it wasn't long and extended. There are others in the Arcadian Vanguard Brotherhood, Barry, who do have long and very at times entertaining rants that go longer than a minute and a half. Mine was only a minute and a half, so by God, I want you, whoever wrote this review, since obviously you're still listening to this show, even though you may not be a part of our face group anymore, to go in. You can include the useless, you can include the annoying, you can even include the very still entertaining, but I want you to take out the shit about me being time-consuming on my rants. That is unfair!
Okay. I don't think, I gotta say, because if we go to the longest and lengthiest rants we've ever had on here, I would imagine, and I don't know this for a fact, I would think my Hannibal rant, my one of three Hannibal rants, were probably the longest, because I just went on forever about those. So I think this is somebody who has a bone to pick with you, whether it's somebody you ticked off based off of your comments last week. Maybe an ex-wife, Jeff, you could be right. Maybe it's somebody who's an Apache. There's always that too, right?
Let's just put it this way. If it is one of my ex-wives, let me just say that I'd like to welcome Sheila and Kelly, my two ex-wives, to the podcast and enjoy the listen, ladies. That's all I'm going to say. Barry, would you like to read the other review?
I would love to because this one is actually a little funnier to me. They hate to be pigeonholed as wrestling fans. Jeff, do we hate – it hates a strong word, Jeff. Do we hate to be pigeonholed as wrestling fans?
Well, I think the fact that we do more than just stick to wrestling, if you will, Barry.
Oh.
Oh. Yes, see, that's what it is. This is fucking McAdam that's writing this review.
Yeah, yeah.
We talk about more than just wrestling here because we talk about – well, Barry, we're known to break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, pop culture. We are known to break kayfabe. It's been a while, Barry.
Life.
That was with a slow, low,
it was angelic,
haltering, you know, tone. It wasn't an annoying, overly excited DJ voice. I'll say that.
We're getting
there. I can do that too. Oh, okay.
Hold your horses,
please,
Tiger.
Please.
We're getting there.
Whoa! Hold on there, Lightning. I borrowed Ron Fuller's horse. Hold on there, Lightning.
Hold. But it remains the only area that regularly interests me. So this person, all they care about is when we talk about wrestling, which, Jeff, we will be talking about wrestling.
Yes,
today.
Good news for this
good
person.
News.
We
yes.
have a good two-thirds of our show today will be primarily dealing with wrestling.
That's
including,
big.
I'm going to say, since we're still in the opening, sure. A one hell of a match, Barry.
It is a hell of a match.
Oh, man. And I thought it was the match of the year for the year it came out. Come to find out, Barry, in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Awards came in number two. Barry, I think we're going to have to review number one because that would have to be one fucking awesome match. Because
yeah, that
of the
is.
Fact that this came in number two. Please continue, Barry.
Absolutely. I'm glad Baldrin recovered. So, right there. Exactly.
Yeah, see, he's trying to go for the babyface role, you know, congratulating me on my recovery from cancer, you know. I appreciate that. That's very thoughtful.
Yeah, he's happy that you've recovered. Look, it was a very serious situation, you know, in the fact that you've recovered, we have made him happy. But this is a big
but,
Jeff, but hearing him discuss Hooters and Styx concerts.
Now, wait a minute.
Like,
you know, I just thought of something,
sure?
Barry.
Sure.
Is he talking about Hooters, the restaurant, or the band Hooters? Because I don't recall ever discussing the band Hooters at all. I don't remember discussing the restaurant Hooters either, unless we're talking about, you know, like bad restaurants that we've done, you know, because, of course, I have to appease Barry with the, you know, food content at least
That's
once
true.
Every four episodes. So
That's true.
Maybe he was talking about Hooters Chicken or the band, the 80s band Hooters. I don't even remember their greatest hit, but please continue, Barry.
I want to say, Jeff, if I'm remembering correctly, you discussed Hooters Chicken Wings a long time ago, like a year ago.
Meaning, so this is a long time listener.
This
we appreciate your patronage, sir.
Yeah, this is somebody. I mean, in going through this, there's a couple of things in here. Actually, there's three or four things in here that really relate to an episode we did 1 or 2 years ago. Even though this review is really from 3 weeks ago.
Listen
this is
to
somebody,
you, Encyclopedia Brown, checking out the clues.
Yeah,
you know.
This is somebody with a grudge to carry, but we're okay with that. So, but hearing him discuss Hooters and Styx concerts is like the small talk at work I try and avoid, albeit in an overly excited DJ voice.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, I'm going to give him points for using the word albeit. That's very good grammatical. I'm a little upset, Barry. You did not give me any props for my use of the Encyclopedia Brown reference, because
I'm reveling in that, Jeff.
J. Sobel, the writer of the Encyclopedia Brown series. Now, let's talk about him claiming that I have an overly excited DJ voice. I really can't believe he said that, and it really annoys me that he would think that I have an overly excited DJ voice, because I can talk as calm and clear, and I can do my Dr. Johnny Fever. Hey, wow, we've got some Barry White coming up on the top of the hour. Yeah. So, you know, it's Barry, is it an act? Am I doing an overly excited DJ voice act here, do you think?
I'd like to say yes, because it would certainly be a lot more interesting. The truth is, this is anybody that knows Jeff, and certainly we've had Fan Fest. A lot of people have met you. I've known you for 30 years. This is exactly how you sound. You're not putting on a fake voice. It's legit. It is a lot more fun if we were to goof on you for doing that. But let's be honest, you're not. This is the way you sound, Jeff.
Okay. Now, next on the agenda in this review, Barry, I think he turns to you.
He does. Yay, my turn. Barry branches out into horror movies seen by 21 people. Well, that's actually true. I think we can all agree this is actually accurate. Now, his grammar is not good at this point, so I could read it the way he wrote it, or I could read it the way he intended it. Barry branches out into horror movies seen by 21 people ever.
Now, here grammatically, I'm going to say if he had included the word maybe between by and 21, so that it said seen by maybe 21 people ever, it would have been grammatically correct. Am I right or wrong?
You're Jeff, you're 100% correct.
Check. This, go ahead.
This is the good one, though. And perving in every 1980s actress. And I'm thinking he meant perving on every 1980s.
I think, Barry, I think here in episode 154, are we going to break kayfabe? Have you ever perved in a 1980s actress of any renown?
Or is
what? Wait a minute. You've waited to 154 fucking episodes to talk about how you boinked some 1980s actress? It better be well known, mister. I don't want some shit fucking, oh, she had one line in an episode of Saved by the Bell or Beverly Hills. Right. I'm talking about 90s show now. I can't think of any 80s show. Oh, she walked on the set of Cheers once. Okay, go ahead.
I like that too. Well, first off, just to finish up, I do perv on every 1980s movie.
Thank
actress,
you.
So I'll give him.
Wait,
that.
You perv on 70s actresses too. Pam Greer, is it
absolutely.
Pam Greer?
Pam Greer.
Did you bring it home? Did you park the car in Pam Greer's garage?
If I had parked the car in that garage, Jeff, you would have heard that on the first episode and every subsequent episode.
Now, is
place.
This a case of you have parked the car in Pam Greer's garage? Inside your head as you're squirting the hand cream and you're going,
I'll admit to that.
Pam, I'm getting ready to park the car, baby. Go ahead. Now, please. Yeah,
and I'll admit to that. Look,
we have a couple of listeners, especially these two people who are waiting to hear which 1980s actress you parked the car in their garage. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I'm going to dedicate this to the person that wrote this. His name is Shaden Friendly. Shaden, I think, is that – I think it's the German spelling. I'm sure Lou could tell us what that means. Is it Shaden?
Wait a minute. Are you claiming that Lou suddenly is a prominent or a German speaker? That's kind of generalizing things. How dare you, sir?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
See?
What is this man doing here?
Das ist richtig. Yes. So I can tell you
that's the German that I know. All the stuff I learned from Hogan's Heroes. Go ahead, Lou.
Well, I think it's a play on the German word Schadenfreude.
Yes,
which is
I've had that at a German restaurant with the Wiener Schnitzel, and yes. It's very good as a side dish.
Well,
yes.
You know, to other people, it means deriving pleasure from the misfortune of others.
Wow. Wait a minute. Well, there you go. Now we know what he was going for here. Okay.
Yeah,
it's all making sense. So it's somebody with some sort of linguistic knowledge of German.
Right. He's a cunning linguist.
Yes.
Cunning linguist.
And that is all the people need to know.
Okay.
Oh, it's the Baron. But he does make this, and this is another clue also, plus, meaning he thinks, meaning me, the AWA was in two states when it once spanned half the continent. I gave them a try, but I'll stick to wrestling. Oh.
Ooh. It's that fucking McAdam again. Does John McAdam write multiple reviews about our podcast? Is that what we're thinking?
But I think I said that a year to 2 years ago. But let's be honest, the AWA never spanned half the continent. You can tell me whatever you want. They were in a minimal amount of states and cities. It was, and this is not a knock on the AWA because I think a lot of the in-ring action was as good, if not better, than anybody else. So certainly better than a lot of the WWF stuff that was taking place. Nick Bockwinkel, I would think one of the greats of all time. This is not, but the AWA was never had the vast scope that that the NWA did. It's a fact. They were never in as many states, and they never had the national exposure that the Northeast promotion, the WWWF, had. So, but I did say this, but I think I said this literally 2 years ago, maybe even longer, Jeff.
So this guy really just grabbed a hold of this little nugget, and he's been chewing on it for two friggin' years,
yeah.
Barry, waiting to call you out on it. I think you and I spoke about this, and I think we came up with approximately 10 states that they appeared in. Let's go now. We said we had Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana. Now, you know, I guess you have to quantify here. When we say the AWA, are we talking about – because, you know, Bockwinkel went to Toronto and defended the belt up there. Was it technically an AWA card, or was it just Bockwinkel appearing as the AWA champion there? He also appeared in Houston. That doesn't mean that Houston's an AWA town, okay? Now, Winnipeg, I know that they ran whole cards that were AWA cards. So, you know, maybe Manitoba, even though it's not technically a state, we have to give them credit for that. And, of course, they ran out in Colorado and they ran in California. They may have ran Utah, too. So, you know, they're up there, 10, 11 states, but we have not yet got to half the country yet.
No, and you won't. But and I think part of the attraction of the AWA, and I remember hearing this, was that it was an easy commute because the states were all so close together. That it was something like Nick Bockwinkel. Somebody had said Nick Bockwinkel would have made a great NWA champion. And I think it was actually discussed at one of the conventions, the NWA conventions. But Bockwinkel apparently didn't want to leave his working schedule in the AWA. He loved the schedule that he had. And Nick Bockwinkel, let me say, would have made an amazing NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. So this really wasn't about the talent in the AWA. This was more about it just wasn't on the broader scale that the NWA was. So
no, but yeah. And you know, as a matter of fact, I think I recall, and maybe we talked about it, hearing something about Nick Bockwinkel ask, I don't know if it was Harley Race or Jack Briscoe or somebody, how many dates did you work as world champion? And
yes,
the answer was like 300 or 325 days out of the
year.
I worked as the NWA champion. And Nick was sitting there thinking, I think I worked max like 180 as the AWA champion. So he basically would have to work almost another 5 months of dates in order to meet the obligations of what the NWA – you know, it's crazy to think about. That, you know, that they were meeting those kind of obligations in that time frame where travel, let's just be honest, was not as easy as it even is today. You know, I mean, think about the fact that Dory Funk Jr. did that for 4 years, you know, and was going to Japan and all that. That's just, it's crazy to think that way. So, but anyway, we appreciate all the reviews on the iTunes and all our other various choices that they have out there besides iTunes. I think it's Lou, join us again. What are the other ones? Is it Stitcher or what are the other ones that we are on?
Oh, Lordy. Possibly Stitcher, perhaps,
yes.
Spotify, maybe,
yes.
Pandora.
Okay.
For sure, Podcast Addict, because that's,
yes,
the app I use.
There you go. So we encourage anyone who's listening on any of those particular apps or networks or whatever to leave us reviews. Tell us what you think. And for those of you in the Breaking Kayfabe with Veteran and Barry group that have not yet been removed from the group, we would encourage you to leave a review as to whether you like us or don't like us. So that being said, now, Barry, that we've addressed those two issues, would you like to continue with the rest of the show?
Do you think we should?
Yes. Oh, wait a All minute. Right. I've completely almost let something slide. Barry,
you have.
Yes. You mentioned something about a 1980s actress. And right now out there, I can tell you that Zaha and Travis and the guys are going, wait a minute, Barry parked the car in the garage of a 1980s actress. Not somebody that just walked on casually on the set of Cheers. Was it an actress of some renown?
It was. So it was an actress that had a featured prominent role on a television. Yes.
This is getting interesting.
It is on a television show. And in her prime, which I would assume she's about 11 years older than me. So she would have been
a bit of a cougar. Huh? Okay.
Yeah. She would have been in her early to mid 30s when this happened. Cause I was in my 20s.
Okay. Go ahead.
She was on, I think it was ABC. She was on a show.
Wait. Okay, I don't interrupt because I have to get to pick out the details of this because our listeners are nothing if they've been on the pervy side themselves and they want all the sordid details. Were you able, Lord Barents, here on episode 154, you MF-er, just bringing this shit up now, were you able to call her by her real name? Or did you use her character's name?
I like that.
Yeah. Because it was like Loretta Swit. You say, can I call you Hot Lips? Oh,
Hot
Lips. Yeah, exactly. So, but go ahead. It was not Loretta Swit. Are we clear on that?
It was not. And here's the thing. I don't know if I ever knew what her character's name was.
Now, is it someone who's ever been a guest on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry?
Not yet, Jeff. Oh. But maybe I can make that call. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember me. I banged you in 1985.
Yes.
Would you be willing to come on and chat about it on our podcast? Okay.
Yeah. And I should say, too, it's why don't we go back to how I met her? So this was Los Angeles. This would have been around the Hollywood area in 1986.
Restaurant were you waiting at?
We were in line at the local Sizzler.
And Sizzler or Western Sizzler Bear?
No, it was Sizzler. I don't know if I've ever been in a Western, but it was Sizzler. It was the $9.99 all-you-can-eat shrimp with steak dinner.
Going so, upscale. Go ahead.
Only the finest. So I was with a good friend of mine, Scott, which I remember. And in front of us was this actress with her mother. And I don't know if the show was still on. It might have been off. But I recognized her right away. And I said to my friend, I said, isn't that the girl from Eight Is Enough?
Interesting.
He said it is. Turns out we all four started talking. Her mother was visiting her from out of town. And I started talking to her. We wound up getting a table together. The four of us sat down. When the night was over, I gave her my phone number. She gave me her phone number. Mm. We met up essentially what was the next day, if I remember correctly.
Hold on, Barry. I got a question.
Sure.
Inquiring minds on the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry message board and the listeners of this podcast want to know, did you do a double header? Did you get her and the mom? Because that would have been good.
Yeah. No. I did not. Let me say, too, the mom she wasn't a cougar hot mom. And I believe
you got to take one for the team sometime, Bear.
Yeah, which is true. I believe this woman, too, the actress was recently divorced or had been within a year or two of us meeting. So long story short, we had a nice dinner. I was clearly way out of my league. I had no business. But at the same time, you know, I was, 22, 23 years old. I absolutely had to make every attempt. We went out for drinks the next night. She lived not too far away. She was in the Hollywood area. And we went out for drinks. We went back to her place. We smoked a big doobie.
Drug usage?
There was, which in 1983 was a little scandalous. Or I'm sorry, 1986. Yeah. That's a little scandalous at that stage. It's not quite the same.
You were breaking laws in several states.
Many states. I think 50, actually.
50. So just to clarify, it was not medicinal marijuana.
I don't believe that even existed in 1986. So it wasn't mine, though. It was hers. But we did. And I got to say.
So you're throwing her under the bus as a drug.
Here's the other part. And just so we can really clarify this, as I'm not really putting myself over.
Oh, no, not at all.
No. Wait. When the act was finished, Jeff, she gave me a kiss on the cheek and told me to have a good night. So, in theory,
did you ever see the movie Dressed to Kill with Angie Dickinson?
Yeah, I certainly have, yes.
Yeah, okay. So do you remember the scene early in the movie when Angie is parking the car in the garage with her husband, the character of her husband, and afterwards he finishes off, but Angie's not quite ready to finish, and he gives her the big little pat on the cheek. You know, thanks, baby. I got mine. Hey, you take care of your own self. So is that what the situation was like? Barry Rose got his, but maybe he left this particular actress a little unsatisfied.
I'm not sure that I was consciously aware if I was good or not at that age. I'm not quite sure. I am even at this age. But
wow.
Yeah, exactly. But certainly at that age.
Lou, get Mrs. Rose on the phone line, too.
I'm not. Yeah, now, that would be a segment, Jeff, actually. You make that happen.
Mrs.
That
Rose right equals would, ratings. Yeah.
Ratings. But I'm not sure. I could sit here and tell you, oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't have any fucking idea. But I can tell you that there was the kiss on the cheek. Mm-hmm. I have to get up early for work the next day.
And it's not you, it's me.
Exactly. And then the walk to the door from
her. Oh, the walk of shame. She
was,
yes,
the walk of shame. But at the same time, I was, you know, I couldn't have been. So anyways, Jeff, we have not said who it was.
I was going to say, do you want to reveal it? Or should we move on to our match of the week?
Yeah, exactly. It was the actress Susan Richardson, who had the long red hair. She was cute. I want to say, I don't know. And I don't know. 86, was the show still on? I think it was, but I don't know. But she was really friendly, I will say that. And she, unfortunately, I want to say between the last 5 and 10 years, I remember reading the story, she's moved to an area. She grew up literally probably a half an hour, 45 minutes from where I live. She's in an area, a suburb of Philly called Coatesville. And she moved back to this area, and she is I want to say she's dramatically underweight. She's lost all of her teeth, severe diabetes. She's had several strokes. She's in really bad shape. And it's actually really sad. I looked her up and I was like just shocked to see this because she was really nice. I mean, I got to say, even though I got the blow off at the end.
Or maybe during. I don't know.
Oh, well, but she couldn't have been she couldn't have been any nicer. So I was saddened to see that. But, Jeff, that is the one 80s actress that I perved in, though I have perved on probably all of them. So that.
Well, so let's give credit to the reviewer for correctly writing that you perved in a 1980s actress. I will say the good news. We have some good news, bad news when it comes to Susan. The good news is. Her character's name was Susan. So you could have called her Susan, and you know, you could have been
the other worked.
Susan Bradford instead of Susan Richardson. I was holding out hope that it was Diane Kaye, who was the attractive sister, the blonde, a little bit on the stupid side the character was, not her. Then, of course, we had Lanny O'Grady, and then we had, Connie Needham, Lori Walter. I never watched the show, though, you know, but.
Oh, you didn't? Yeah, you never saw.
No, not at all. So
it must have been a terrible show, and I only say it because of all the shows that are in repeats in reruns on television, I don't think I've ever seen Eight Is Enough ever.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I thought for a minute you were going to sing the theme song, which was actually the show, Barry. I'm just looking on the old IMDb site, 1977 to 1981.
Oh, so she was long.
Yeah, she
removed.
Was way. Yeah. So she probably looked. She said, here's this guy with a full head of hair. Because this was 1985.
That's it. Thin, full head of hair.
Yeah, exactly.
Teeth, right.
You know, and well, that's important to some people.
And, you know, it was important. Sure. Exactly. Very important back then.
So of course, the last question, unfortunately, we've also seen that she did undergo some sort of nervous breakdown in 1999, which is very sad to hear. But before we leave this
segment, she was on drugs as well. I mean, and not to
– Well, that would explain her picking you up. But
that would absolutely explain it. I think there was a cocaine addiction, which was pretty common back in the 80s. But I think there was a cocaine addiction as well.
Yes. So – and I guess the last question that the readers and the listeners would want me to ask, Bear.
Sure.
How long? Was it a good 2 minutes? Did you give her 10? Did you go full hour like Nature Boy Ric Flair, you know?
I think.
Or was it about 20 seconds and that's why you got the slap on the face and I got to work in the morning?
Was it 44 minutes, not including commercials?
And did you hear the voice of Dick Van Patten in your ear?
Yes, yes. So
going, Susan, you're out late again.
You're out late, yeah. It was, I honestly was there for, I guess the whole act was a little while. I believe I shot the rocket more than once.
Whoa, very impressive.
Oh yeah. Oh, Jeff, I was 22 years old. That's not really impressive. That's expected at that age.
Actually, that would be easily explained then. So, did you provide any protection, or did Miss Susan have her own protection at the time, or what?
She actually had protection.
Oh, she told you that story. So there could be somewhere in another part of
the VA. No.
A young Mr. Rose.
No, it was physical protection. I don't think
removed?
I actually had it. Yeah, I think
you removed?
I think removed. Yeah, yeah. No, I think she actually had it. Yeah. I was under the impression that this was a well laid out plan for her to get laid. I'm not saying that meanly. I'm saying that I don't think I was the first or last in that.
What?
Yeah, exactly. So, but I'm just grateful that I was able to do that. So.
Did you feel afterwards? Did you feel kind of like cheap and whorish?
No, not at all. No, okay. And I still don't. I still don't. Yeah. I don't. I was okay with it.
So let's talk about some other stuff, although I think we may have topped the Ethiopian story, Barry, at this point.
Wow.
With the knowledge that you parked the car in the garage of a famous 1980s sitcom actress. And we raise an adult beverage to not only to Susan, but the cast of Eight is Enough, the great Willie Ames, Grant Goodeve, Adam Rich, Dick Van Patten, Betty Buckley, and I believe Lou mentioned earlier Diana Hyland, who is dating John Travolta at the time of the first season, died, and that's why they had to bring in Betty Buckley, who I think you pointed out earlier is still on Broadway performing Cats at the age of approximately 104. So
still out there. Memories.
So now let's move on to a part of the show where, Barry, we stick to wrestling for a little bit because now that we've got the hooks in the listener, now we can go back to the wrestling stuff. So this week on our show, we are going to be taking a look at Match of the Week that, Barry, is the word utterly fantastic. Actually, that's two words. Would that be adequate to describe this match?
I think so, and I think for one of the participants, I think it's the best match I've ever seen this guy ever have. I think by far.
I think that's fair. So we're going to talk about our match of the week. Then we are going to be discussing a little topic that came up on Twitter, and that involves the greatest heels of all time. Now, when I say the greatest heels of all time, I don't just mean somebody that made money as a heel, okay? I mean somebody that was a great heel because they got not just great heat at ringside, they got scary heat at ringside. And I think there's a definite quantitative difference between the kind of heat that somebody like, I don't know, I know they just turned Roman Reigns, for God's sake, what he's getting in the ring and what guys that are working, even in AEW, MJF, who I love the character of MJF, he's doing a great job. But I don't know if he's getting the kind of heat that some of these guys in the 60s, 70s, and even into the 80s got, Barry. Would that be fair to say?
I don't think it. I think based off of the world that we live in currently. And
definitely plays a part in it.
Absolutely. You'll never get that same. When people believe, Jeff, that was real heat.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get to the match of the week. We are going to August 31st, 1993, to the rings of All Japan Wrestling. It is the great, and boy, do I mean the great, Kenta Kobashi taking on Steve Dr. Death Williams. Barry, tell the folks what you thought of this match.
So as we mentioned, Kenta Kobashi had matches that were, he comes across as this likable guy now. And we were talking last week off air about this, where we basically said Misawa obviously is passed on. Kawada just looks like he's been put through a meat grinder. He just looks brutalized. But Kobashi looks great, and Kobashi has taken so much punishment. You know, I don't think he's got any cartilage left in his knees. He's just been as brutalized, yet just appears to be super happy and just looks great. But Steve Williams, in long since past, Steve Williams probably gone for 14, 15 years at this point. This is probably the best match that I've ever seen him in. And he had some good matches like in the UWF, Bill Watts, Mid-South and UWF. But Steve was kind of limited into what he could do, at least the way wrestling was being presented back then. But in Japan, obviously, it's a different ball game. And Steve Williams, this match is phenomenal. He looks like $1 million in this match. He really does. This is strong work right out of the gate. It's a great atmosphere. The fans are completely into doing everything that these two are doing. And we've talked about it. We haven't said it recently, but crowds are so important. Noise, I can watch Impact Wrestling, and I like Impact, and they do some good stuff, but it's pretty quiet when these matches are taking place. And Eddie Edwards, who lost the Impact World title to Eric Young a couple weeks back, he was defending this title every week. And, you know, when a guy goes in for the three count and gets the three count, you expect that pop. And if it doesn't occur, it, you know, if there's nobody there to cheer them on, when the world champion wins and there's nobody winning, clapping, booing, cheering, whatever it is, it comes across so fucking flat. This is the complete opposite, because the fans, they're hanging on every single move that these two do. And these guys are really doing a lot. You're getting some really stiff shots from both these guys. Hard chops. I mean, Kobashi and his chops. Slaps, kicks, punches. Everything you expect. The expressions from both these guys. You talk about the selling. It's $1 million from both guys. They're doing everything. There's a DDT to Williams on the floor, a German suplex onto Williams' head that you've got to see to believe. The military press slam to Kobashi on going to the floor. There's a scoop slam to Kobashi on the floor. You know, it just everything about it is just amazing. And then you get to the ending, and it's really, it's as stiff as they get. Williams destroying Kobashi at the end with three backdrop suplexes. They're just brutal. They're scary to watch. I don't have any idea how Kobashi was able to stand after this. It's just amazing. You know, I can't say enough about how amazing this match is. The beginning and the end are the highlights. In the middle, there's a couple of moments where it drags a little bit, but like everything, you know, this is a story. You've got the beginning, the middle, and the end, and this is the kind of storytelling that we don't always see in professional wrestling these days. This match, though, you got to go out of your way to see this.
So the match goes 27 minutes. It is absolutely superior. You know, I want to say the last 3 or 4 weeks, Barry, I think we've done some matches that were they were entertaining. I think we had what was the match we had that we just both kind of realized wasn't that? Oh, the Bob Orton, Adrian Adonis match. I know you didn't like that at all.
Yeah,
this was in fucking incredible. I mean, I started watching this and I was like, wow, because you know Barry mentioned that they chop one another. Now this is not a case. As fate would have it, I watched another match that was from this country. It was a WCW match. And I won't say who was involved in the match other than to say that Ric Flair was in it. And Ric Flair was chopping, and the guy that he was facing was chopping, because I won't reveal it, because it might be a match of the week coming up here in another couple of weeks, Mr. Rose. And what happened was I noticed they were slapping more for the sound effect. And it was absolutely deafening. I mean, like you could tell that it was slapping for sound and impact. Kobashi and Steve Williams were chopping each other to hurt one another. They were like chopping to cave in the guy's chest. There's a definite difference that you'll notice when you watch this, because they are chopping to hurt. There's a moment where they begin slapping one another, and it just was like it must go on for, 15, 20 seconds, where they're slapping, I mean, the shit out of one another. And, you know, both of them getting slaps in that it just have to hurt. And, you know, and then Barry mentioned the ending of the match where Doc drops Kobashi as a back suplex onto one of them. I think he landed right on the top of his head, and the other two he landed on the back of his neck. And, you know, especially when you stop and consider, that's the kind of stuff that killed Mitsuhara Misawa. And to know, and of course, obviously this is before his death, but you think, wow, we're incredibly lucky that Kobashi is still alive. And if I'm not incorrect, I believe didn't Kobashi have like a cancer scare or something like that towards?
Oh yeah, he did. Kidneys, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and so I'm wondering whether or not that kidney scare, having the cancer might have ended up saving his life, because you know there was a period of time where he wasn't taking those incredible bumps like that. And you know, I was thinking while you started talking, Barry, we reviewed another one of his singles matches against Samoa Joe. And that was a great match too. Kobashi for so long was just one of the great, great wrestlers in the world. And as I started watching this match, so what's interesting about Kobashi is Kobashi, I want to say, first started showing up on TV about 1988 for the All Japan guys and Giant Baba. which was also about the time that guys like Muto and Chono and Hashimoto started showing up regularly on TV. They might have been a year before, but you know, Liger, the younger guys in New Japan started showing up, and that was quite the generation of talent. But Kobashi, the way that Baba booked his finishes and the way that he promoted was you really had to get to the point where the crowd was dying for you to win. Very famous story that I think we've told here before is that when Misawa was finally put over on Barry's number one guy, Jumbo Tsuruta, it was literally called in the dressing room the night of the show when Giant Baba peeked out, saw the crowd, saw the way the crowd was reacting, and called it right there on the fly and says, Misawa's going over on tonight. And he said, and Jumbo famously was supposed to have said, oh, you mean a count out or what? He goes, no, he's gonna pin you tonight. And that was the first time that Jumbo had heard about it. And so Kobashi was, you know, there was a period of times where as you watch this match, the fans are literally hanging on with every move and every slap of the mat for a pinfall count because they so want Kobashi to finally get that big win. And, you know, here he's against Doc, who's, you know, Doc was not at the level of like Stan Hansen or Bruiser Brody, but he was a big deal at this point, you know, for the American side. And so as they're counting, you know, one, two, and then Kobashi would kick out, or Doc would kick out of Kobashi's move. Oh, the crowd was just like, oh, you could just see like the life was going out of them because they were hanging on every, and that's the way you book somebody. That's the way over time. And that's what made Giant Baba such a great promoter was that when the time came and when he called for that spot where the other guy was going over, it was a guy who was ready for the spot. He had been prepped for the spot, and by God, the fans were ready for him to get that pin. And so, you know, this was not a spoiler alert for a match that's 27 years old here, Barry. But exactly. You know, it was not his night to get the win, but he gained so much in losing, you know, and that's the sign of somebody that's great is that he's still able to maintain that adoration from the crowd. And oh my God, it's just the you know, and we've said this in 154 episodes. We probably said it 145 times. The emotion of the crowd, Barry, as they are just trying to will Kobashi to victory, was really something to behold.
It was too, and you know, again, the crowds are so important to wrestling, and I think that's what I because even now, you know, if you watch wrestling and whether they've got you know, I think AEW is actually letting some fans in. To where they're taping, and then there are wrestlers around. NXT, I think, is using certain talents around the ringside. It's not the same. You need the crowd. And Japanese crowds, they've always been known for that, Jeff. They've always been known for knowing when to pop. They're so educated. You know, the fans over there, they know when to pop, and it really adds so much. It adds so much drama to a match. This is just fantastic, though.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting how – you know, as I was thinking this afternoon, you know, AEW, I realize it's a brand new promotion. They've got to create new stars. That's absolutely something they have to do. They have, you know, the older guys that, or guys that have been around for a while, Jericho, even guys like Omega or the Young Bucks, names that people have probably heard. But, you know, your guys like MJF, your guys like Orange Cassidy, your guys like, oh, God, what the hell is a skateboarder's name? I'm drawing a complete blank.
Darby Allin.
Darby Allin, okay. Who I think is going to be a huge deal, okay? And, you know, we talked about Wardlow and Lance Archer. These are guys that they're creating, and they're doing a great, Lord knows they're doing a great job on the Hangman, Adam Page, and creating him as like a stone cold kind. But in the United States, they do not have the ability to especially because they're competing with the WWE in some regard, not totally, but because they have to get over these young stars, they don't have the ability to let it marinate like, you know, Baba did at this point, where he could let somebody eat 2, 3, 4 years where the guy wasn't getting that big victory. Maybe the victory would be in a tag match, or the fact that he really came close in a match like, you know, like this against Dr. Death or somebody like Terry Gordy, where he almost had it, and the fans are leaving the building that night going, oh, he was so close. I bet you the next time that's when he's going to get the win, and it brings him back into the arena. And maybe AEW doesn't have that ability to let their upcoming stars marinate the way that Baba did, and the position that Baba was in was Baba had been a successful promoter at this point for, geez, almost 25 years. So he had more of that ability and was more well known to allow that marinating to go on, Barry.
Yeah, exactly, too. And Baba, too, it's there's a guy that we don't we may not, you know, talk about or recognize enough, because certainly Baba as a wrestler, at least in the stage when you and I really got to see him, he was extremely limited, and he's a legend, which is why he was out there. A lot of times it was in comedy matches and things like that. But as a promoter, I would say Baba's top three, Jeff, of all time, maybe top five.
Yeah, I don't think there's much question about that.
He
not only was a great promoter, he paid the guys well. He treated them with respect. Guys that were regulars in Japan wanted to go there because they were treated so well, you know. And a huge surprise, why would a wrestler, knowing the way the industry worked at various times in this time frame, 70s, 80s, or 90s, you know, why wouldn't they want to work for a guy that was a good promoter?
Yeah, too. And that, yeah, there's from guys that have worked for Baba. When Baba said something to you, he gave you his word, you never had to worry about it. His contract was a handshake. And he just had, you know, there were certain people, and we were talking about this, I guess a couple of weeks ago on the podcast, but in the Facebook group as well, about people that, you know, you just never hear a negative word about. And he was one of those. I think Bob is one of those that there's always going to be somebody, but at the end of the day, so many people had respect for him, but the way that he dealt with people. You know, it wasn't just that he was a bright guy, that he had at one time the hottest wrestling promotion in the entire U.S., but here was a guy that was trustworthy. This was a guy that, you know, was going to do the right thing by you.
Yeah, and he was definitely a guy that if he said, I'm going to pay you X amount of dollars, didn't come to you on payoff day and go, I'm going to pay you a little bit less. You know, that was just not something that was ever done with him.
Correct.
Yeah. So before we get to our discussion about heels who had the real heat, very quickly, Barry, a friend of the show, a friend of, I want to say a friend of ours, Jerry Briscoe, received some rather tough news this week as he got a letter from the WWE corporate.
Yeah, it was, I forget what day this broke. We're recording on a Monday. I want to say it was Thursday or Friday, just 3 or 4 days ago. And Jerry posted something. I believe he had been furloughed, which had occurred back in April, if I'm correct. And he posted that after 36 years with the WWE, he had been let go officially. And the tone of his posting was, it almost came across as one of like confusion. He was obviously very hurt by it and just asked for a little privacy. He wanted to acknowledge that it occurred and then said, I'll be ready to talk when the time comes. And, you know, it's one of those things. And I went back and I wanted to make sure that when we were going to speak about this today, that I had my facts correct. But everything that I have seen, and I went back to old observers, which is really the best information tool that I have. When Jerry and Jack basically sold to Vince, which would have been 1984, one of the conditions was they had a job for life. And Jack obviously decided just a few months after that he was done with wrestling. I don't know financially if he was still being taken care of at any point. I'm not sure. But Jerry continued, and Jerry was on-air talent. Jerry was part of the Stooges with Patterson. You would see him every so often. And I know in the last few years, he was pretty much off of TV, though I think he came back briefly for the 24/7 title. But Jerry had had some health issues. I know that he had had knee surgery, and then he had some other health issues, and he wasn't traveling the same. But what he was doing, Jeff, is he was a scout for the WWE, and he would go to college sports, football, wrestling, whatever it might be. And he would go and he would scout athletes, and then he would report back to Vince. And Jeff, if you remember when we had Jerry Briscoe and Patterson at one of our fan fests down in Florida, Jerry came directly from the airport. He had been in Denver scouting for the WWE. So all indications, you know, was that Jerry was promised a job for life. And I would assume the handshake, whether it was handshake or not, from Vince McMahon really doesn't mean shit, because if this is accurate, Jerry was released last week. After 36 years, he is no longer receiving a paycheck from the WWE.
Well, I'm sure the reason that Vince had to let Jerry go is because of Vince's obvious financial difficulties. That was a little bit of sarcasm there.
Oh, just a little, sure.
Just a little bit, yeah. So, all right, now let's get on to our topic this week, which is the great heels and the greatest heels ever as far as generating heat at ringside or in the buildings. Let me tell you the genesis of this. As I said, I was looking on Twitter the other day, and there was actually a statement by somebody. Somebody had sent a tweet to Dave Meltzer and asking him whether or not, in fact, Randy Orton was the greatest heel in the history of the wrestling business.
Wow.
And so, yeah, that's pretty much everything. I got to be honest with you. I don't watch the WWE. I fully admit that. I understand from everything I read about it that he's a very, very, very good talent. Still has very good matches. He's a very good heel at what he does. But let's be honest. Putting Randy Orton in the stratosphere of greatest heels of all time, or saying, in fact, not even that, saying that he is the greatest heel of all time, is a little bit of a stretch, just a wee bit of a stretch. So I started in my mind, you know, because I know we talked about heels before, I don't know, it could have been 100 episodes ago, Barry. So what I wanted to specifically do was I wanted to talk about, let's talk about guys that were great at generating heat at ringside in the buildings, to the point where it's a little bit scary. And the guys really had to know either how to control it or how to get out of there when the when it got to be a little too hot. The other thing was, last week's episode had an obituary for a guy named Tom Andrews. Tom Andrews was a veteran wrestler. I actually reached out to Barry and said, did he wrestle in Florida? And I believe he had a very, very limited amount of appearances in Florida. Correct, Barry?
That's right. Yes, that's absolutely correct.
So, but Tom wrestled up in the Nebraska and the Omaha area in the early 70s. He wrestled as a character called the Claw, okay, who, guess what his finishing move was. Okay, so there was a point, this territory at one point was pretty well regarded as being a good place to work. The Dusick brothers, I think, were the ones running the territory. And there was an incident where one of the Torres brothers, I want to say, Lou, please correct me, jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, that it was Enrique, who died of some sort of heart attack or something like that. There was an attempt to put the blame on Tom Andrews and his character of the Claw for having killed the Torres guy.
Hmm. Well, I want to say, I'm thinking of, might be Alberto Torres.
Okay, maybe it was Alberto.
And it was, I might be mixing up things, but I think it was pinned on Ox Baker, the same way they did with Ray Gunkel.
But I know that as the Claw, he was somehow involved in that whole angle. Maybe he wasn't the one that was blamed, but it was kind of very shady booking to do something like that. And anyway, thanks, Luke. And so, so what happens is, Tom Andrews also was part of, I want to say, the Interns. He went down and was part of a tag team down in Bama, where in the early 70s, they did an angle with the wrestler Bearcat Brown, where they painted, if not his entire body, they painted his back white. And because, you know, as a black wrestler in Alabama, especially a babyface, and of course, needless to say, this angle got lots of heat, even in the early 70s. But what I thought was interesting was that they were managed at the time, and this is a guy that we really haven't talked about a lot, was a guy named Dr. Ken Ramey. And Dr. Ken Ramey had a very interesting quote, was quoted as saying that the one thing he never wanted to do was he never wanted the manager of a heel wrestler or heel team to be put in a position where he's going to be made fun of. You know, like, or he's going to do stuff for comedy. Now you think about it, Bobby Heenan would do stuff for comedy, Jim Cornette, other great, you know, you listen to Ron Fuller's Studcast and they forever, you know, you have forever talks about Homer Odell, getting, doing his blubbery voice and trying to talk his way out of getting in trouble. as a way of being humorous. So obviously it's a thing that each individual promoter likes to do differently. Some like to get heat on their characters through comedy. And I understand that when it's used, you know, effectively, it can be. But in Dr. Ken Ramey's opinion, he only wanted that to happen when the character was done and was getting ready to leave the territory. Then he said, then you can get heat on me or do something comedic with me where I'm being made fun of or I do something that causes the audience to laugh only on the way out, which I thought was it's kind of an interesting a booking thought. Don't you think, Bear?
It's genius, actually. Absolutely.
Yeah. So now all this inspired me to reach out to his lordship and say, Barry, who are the top five guys that you would say at getting heat? And I want to quantify this. This is not like the guys that drew the most at the box office or anything like that. I'm talking strictly at a guy that when you went to the matches or you watched on TV or pay-per-view or whatever, and you said, wow, that guy has really got the crowd worked up. And suffice to say, it's not going to be some of the guys that you think, okay? Now, I will also tell Barry for the first time, I have not revealed this to him, I Uh-oh. Reached out to friends of the show, including Ron Fuller, Pete Lederberg,
what?
Howard Baum,
who?
Yes, Bruce Mitchell, other brother Jeff Steele, to see fans whose opinions that I respect involving, at least in pro wrestling, because Baum, other than pro wrestling, I really don't respect Howard Baum's opinion or anything. That's a little joke, Howard. And so, but people that have been around the wrestling business for over 40 years and have had their chance to see the good and bad heels out there, you know, tell me what you think are guys that you have seen. So, Barry, before we get to their opinions, why don't you offer us, I ask you to pick five. Give me two of the names, not necessarily the number one. Give me your five and four pick.
Yeah, so what's interesting too, Jeff, I picked seven. I can
you
remove
son of a bitch.
Exactly. But I can remove one and put him to something current in some ways. And I would have to remove one. But I will give you. So and I think what's important about this, too, because I know I reached out. These aren't going to be my favorite heels of all time.
No, and there's a difference.
Absolutely. There's a huge difference. What you tasked us to do is give me the top five heels in professional wrestling of all time. And the important statement you made is guys that when they walked out into an arena, a riot was ready to break out at any time because they were so hated. So I'll give you my number five, which is Mad Dog Vachon. So I never saw Mad Dog Vachon in his prime. I can tell you when Mad Dog was a heel, everything that I have read, everything that I might have seen via YouTube, but through studying wrestling history, Mad Dog Vachon was a hated, hated heel.
Okay, I'm going to give you my number five now. My number five, a man that, based on everything that I've heard about him, did not have to work hard to be a heel because he's kind of a grumpy guy to begin with. That's Ole Anderson. Ole Anderson. All you have to do is, not taking aside the cage match in Atlanta where he turned on Dusty, which if you've never seen that, you really need to go out of your way to see that because that's absolutely fantastic. The people wanted to tear the cage down to get Ole and Gene Anderson for their here's a word we haven't used in a while on this podcast, if ever, Barry, their dastardly attack on the American Dream. So Ole Anderson, a fantastic, fantastic heel. Who would your number four be?
My number four. This might be the guy that people – and I think they wanted to kill him for a different reason. Gorgeous George, the original Gorgeous George. Here was a guy that – here was a guy – wrestling was a blue-collar sports entertainment, whatever it was. And it catered to the blue-collar. And all of a sudden, you've got this guy coming out with this primped-up hair and these fancy robes, and he's got someone spraying perfume in the ring. And boy, did that piss a lot of these blue-collar workers off. So really, and here's a guy, too, that a lot of professional wrestling in sport – look, Muhammad Ali said that he patterned – a lot of what he did based off of Gorgeous George. And I think you can look and see that a lot of the guys that, Adrian Street, Gorgeous George Jr., but, Adrian Adonis, even in later years, a lot of guys realized this was a great way to draw some serious heat.
Yeah, no, no question about it. My number four is a guy. Now, here's what I think is interesting. Was not mentioned by, I don't think, by any of the people that I reached out to. Okay. And I will say that this guy, the stories that I've heard about Ron Wright, Barry, they burned his fucking plane down in Hazard, Kentucky. He had his own private plane that he traveled to the different towns in. They burned his plane down, Barry. That's the kind of heat that Ron Wright would get in Tennessee and in the other areas that he worked. And I got to tell you, the only chance I had to see Ron Wright was in Smoky Mountain. I did, you know, of course, didn't have access. He's on YouTube and to some degree. But the angle that they worked in Smoky Mountain, where Ron Wright came out in the wheelchair as the manager of the Dirty White Boy, and he had a heart condition that he was had on medication for. And I always loved the fact that he didn't say he had arthritis. Barry, he had arthritis. And, that's so great because that's the way my grandmother in South Carolina used to say, I got the arthritis. And so, that's so awesome. Classic. But they took this angle, and I mean to tell you, Jimmy must have stretched this thing out as the owner and promoter of Smoky Mountain. Jim Cornette must have stretched this thing out for a year or two where Ron's in the wheelchair. And then when it comes time, I think it was for Dirty White Boy to win the Smoky Mountain title maybe or something like that. But it was a big blow-off match, maybe against Tracy Smothers. And at ringside, finally Ron Wright gets up out of the wheelchair and cost the Dirty White Boy's opponent the match. And then he left. And oh my God, it was absolute genius the way they stretched that out and just showed what a tremendous heel Ron Wright was.
Yeah, and that's a good point about the plane being destroyed. And you go back and especially
Hazard, Kentucky.
When you and I was in Hazard, Kentucky, when they had the WFIA convention, Ron Wright was there. He was managing Condrey and Hickerson. But I was in Hazard. Hazard is a, if I'm correct, is a coal mining town. And there are some tough mother effers in that town, Jeff. yeah.
Do we have anybody in our group from Hazard, Kentucky? I'm interested. Let's see if someone posts.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's that is a tough part. And wasn't like Loretta Lynn or somebody from that part of the world? I don't know. Maybe
she was from. Oh my God! Wait a minute. I have to think of this.
I feel like somebody like in the country music world or something was from.
No, Hazard, she was from Butcher's Holler.
Oh boy, that's right. The Butcher's Holler,
coal miner's daughter. Wow, yeah. I really pulled that one out of my hat.
You did. You pulled it out of somewhere. You definitely did.
But you got Susan Richardson. I'm pulling up Loretta Lynn
out of your ass of all places, exactly. Too. Go figure. Yeah, but that's a really good point. It makes me. I think this expands the scope of the list too, because you think of some of these guys that were working in the smaller territories in the Deep South. And if they were a heel, boy, imagine that kind of heel.
Oh, my God. Yeah. They
be nuclear. Yeah.
They dealt with stuff that I'm sure that we have absolutely no idea.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Of what kind of stuff that they had to deal with. Okay. So before we give our top three each, I'm going to talk about some of the stuff that guys that we reached out to. Let's go with Howard H. Baum, the magnificent one. Howard's top five, he says, are Killer Carl Cox. Now, Barry, you've been around Florida a long time.
Yes.
And I know you love Cox. discuss what it was like to have a swinging Cox around you at ringside.
So, yeah, he was big, too. He's a big Cox. So Killer Carl Cox will always be an anomaly in professional wrestling. And the fact that he looked like your grandfather, he was paunchy, like he had never been in a gym. He was balding. He looked 50, even though he may have only been 35 or 40. But he had this amazing way where he could walk out and he would get extreme heat from the crowd. It was all psychology. He was very entertaining in the ring. But I was going to put Cox on my list, and then I decided that almost seems impartial. I also know people were also expecting me to put Cox on the list. So I'm actually really happy that Howard Baum did that. But he is one of the great heels of all time.
Well, I'm sure perhaps that you might have included on your list Howard's next choice, the Funker, Terry Funk.
I mean, It, without a doubt, too. And I did include Terry Funk, so I will scratch that one, and I'll go with one of the reserves right now. Terry Funk, much like Cox, but as far as similarities, Terry Funk could be the most hated guy in the entire state and could figure out a way 2 weeks later to be the most popular guy. And that really was, I think, and Cox did that as well. Cox went from the most hated professional wrestler in the state of Florida, and almost overnight, when he saved the father of Steve Kern, who was Colonel Richard Kern, who was getting the claw from Pac Song, Killer Carl Cox went in and broke it up, and all of a sudden he was this massive, and that's genius booking too, but this massive baby face. So we said this last week, you know, if you're a great heel and you're truly hated, people have invested emotionally in you, meaning you could then turn babyface and they're going to stick with you. And we've seen that happen.
Well, you know, part of what I was going to include in this, I ended up not doing it, but let's just very briefly sidetrack, because I was going to include guys that had tremendous runs, not only as heels, but as adored babyfaces too. And, you know, you think of Terry. My God, he was like a wrestling god to the All Japan fans over there. On his retirement match, there were people openly weeping in the crowd about the fact that Terry was talking about, you know, was supposed to retire. Of course, he didn't. But, you know, think about it. Terry giving the devil his due. Hulk Hogan was as over a babyface as ever was in this country. And then when he turned and joined the NWO, you know, Tony Schiavone's famous line, your garbage smells, and so do you. Or now that I've pointed that out, I can't remember the fucking line. But right. You know, he said something.
You go to hell, Hulk Hogan.
Thank you. Didn't he say something about garbage, Lou? There was some kind of comment about Hulk Hogan's garbage.
Can't recall.
Okay, well, I fucked that up. So anyway, I'm sure we're now going to get an iTunes review where Bowdern fucks up everything. So, but I mean, the point is that there are guys that not just like a brief run as a baby face after a long run as a heel, but guys who had, you know, Jerry Lawler, sustained run as a baby face in Memphis. And then, geez, how long was he a heel up in the WWE? How long did he have, you know, he had runs either before and after he was a legendary baby face in Memphis. Before, talk about guys that probably had problems on the road before he became a baby face. Think about Jerry Lawler in the Memphis area traveling with Sam Bass and Jim White. You know, those guys probably had nuclear heat around Memphis and all the different towns they went to. That's how great a heel Jerry Lawler was, and people don't realize that, before he became the beloved king in Memphis.
Yeah, and he was, you know, Jerry went back and forth in the 70s and the 80s. So he was back and forth all the time. And here's the other aspect of that, and you're right, Jeff, you're 100% correct. Jerry Lawler was not a tough guy. He'll be the first one to tell you, you know, Jerry Lawler was a professional wrestler, but he wasn't a true tough guy. So some of the shit he's facing in some of these smaller towns in Tennessee or Kentucky or Arkansas, which is maybe why he was running with, you know, Sam Bass, who I think was a tough guy.
Yeah. And no one's ever going to confuse Jerry Lawler with Harley Race in a restaurant or bar situation. And I don't think that's a huge insult to Jerry Lawler, and I don't think he would take it that way. So the next guy would fit into that category of beloved babyface, hated heel, and that's Roddy Piper. That's on Howard's list, by the way. So, yeah, Roddy Piper, Barry.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
Stabbed in the Mid-Atlantic.
Stabbed in the Mid-Atlantic. Roddy Piper, you know, a lot of people talk about it. Could Hulk Hogan have been Hulk Hogan without Piper right out of the gate? If you didn't have a heel that was – and Roddy Piper was never a great professional wrestler as far as in-ring quality. But if you didn't have a personality that was as dynamic as Roddy Piper, as somebody that would literally jump out of the screen and grab you by the throat and shake you around, as frenetic, as crazy as Piper, could Hogan have been – as big a star? And I don't think so. And I'll tell you why. Take a guy like Greg Valentine. And Greg Valentine, you know, by all means, by the early to mid 80s, at the time that Hulk Hogan was exploding, Greg Valentine, as an in-ring worker, I think many would consider the best. As a personality, he was kind of flat. And it's not a knock on Greg Valentine, but he wasn't known for this outrageous personality that's going to translate to television. And Piper was. And I think that's why. I think Piper was the right guy for Hogan at the time. And I think to that point is one of the greatest heels of all time.
Yeah. And the next guy that Howard brings up, another guy that you had a chance to see a lot of in Florida, and that is King Curtis.
Yeah, King Curtis was – he was great too. So I thought about putting King Curtis on my list. And again, you know, there are so many of these guys, but I also wanted to branch out and I wanted to look at the history of professional wrestling, not just guys that I thought based out of Florida. King Curtis was, though. He was especially the first time you ever saw King Curtis because he would come out, he had that booming voice, and he would yell in every match. And physically, he was frightening to look at. I mean, we had never seen anybody who ever looked like that. He was a great heel. And as improbable as this sounds, Jeff, he translated into a great babyface, which was a feud with the Assassin in 1976, where they turned King Curtis babyface. And I got to tell you, the matches between those two were some of the best I think I ever saw.
And the last name on Howard's list is Bruiser Brody. You, of course, have discussed on prior occasions on this show when he came to Florida as Frank the Hammer Goodish. And I think his first appearance on television, he won the Florida title from Rocky Johnson.
Did, came out of nowhere. It was Christmas Day of 1975, and we didn't know who Frank Goodish was. He had I think, worked in only two territories at the time, which would have been West Texas and the Oklahoma McGurk territory. And I don't think we even knew who he was, or, you know, if we did, he was part of a tag team with Stan Hansen, but he was also a young rookie. And all of a sudden, this guy shows up on TV, and he squashes Rocky Johnson. I mean, it was literally a squash and wins the Florida title. You talk about getting a guy over in one match. This is the way you do it. Unfortunately, from that point forward, it was all downhill for him in the state of Florida. He never achieved what we thought he was going to achieve, did come back years later in the 80s, and was pushed as a much, much, much bigger star.
Okay, our next list of choices comes from veteran wrestling scribe Bruce Mitchell, the man I call the original BM. Bruce very thoughtfully chose to not just give me names, but give me the moments that he wanted to describe different individuals having great heat. So I will read you what Mr. Mitchell wrote. Heels I saw live getting the big heat at specific times. 1980 Greensboro Coliseum, U.S. champion Jimmy Snuka outside the ring shrugged his massive shoulders at fans who jumped back. Just by a shrug. By the Superfly and the fan, oh boy, if they only knew, they would have been glad they jumped. So 1984 Greensboro Coliseum Battlestar, baby doll in high heels walking on concrete, getting pelted with beer and ice and trash, accompanying NWA World TV Champion Tully Blanchard to the ring. How she didn't bust her ass is beyond me. She is then suspended in a cage above the ring. Same night, after Dusty beats Tully for the World TV belt, he and Wahoo, the awesome twosome, beat Dusty bloody, and NWA champ world champ Ric Flair runs out to save Dusty. Well, we forgot about that time period, huh? And gets his head rammed, gets his head slammed against the shark cage. Crimson flowing, can barely stand. The Nature Boy has now got to do the impossible, beat Wahoo in a strap match no one ever has, if he wants to keep the NWA Heavyweight Championship. And that match is next. Wahoo comes back for the big match. A mob of fans surround him from every side. They're actually punching him. I would not recommend having done that in the past, by the way, to Wahoo McDaniel, based on what I've heard. They're actually punching him. Not that it does anything. He points at one fan, slugs him. Guy goes down. He does the same to two more. Okay, so that's Snuka, the doll, and Wahoo. Now, 1986, Dorton Arena, Raleigh, North Carolina, Ric Flair beats on Ricky Morton during an NWA title match. Finally, somebody sells for the champ and the windows shake from the high-pitched screaming. So I guess he's giving it to Flair there. His final one, 1980, the LA Coliseum, IWC, Ron Skolar as the promoter, Jake Roberts in a tag cage match against Perro Aguayo. The Snake does jack shit, nothing, but boy, do the fans hate Jake Roberts. I remember that.
I remember that too. That was
right around the time that Jake lost his hair in a hair match.
Yep, that's right.
And he was absolutely amazing. I think that's what ended up getting him the job with WCW for a while.
Yep.
You know, where he came out of the guy, Sting, I knew you'd come. Let's see, who could forget that? Let's see. Okay, next we're going to go to, well, let me pull up our next bit of choices here. The Professor Pete Lederberg. Thinking about it off the top of my head, I would have to say the Sheik, Ed Farhat. Bear.
Yeah, so the Sheik was number one on my list. And partly with the Sheik, too, I think people tend to remember the older Sheik, where he would come out, he would have four-minute matches. You knew right away the pencil was making an appearance 30 seconds out. Blood would then be out 45 seconds into the match, and 2 minutes later, the match is over. That was Steiner math, by the way, Jeff. I don't know if you caught that.
No, it's very impressive.
But I would have to say what the Sheik did, not only in Detroit, but Toronto, I think is unparalleled in the history of professional wrestling. As a heel, it's unparalleled. You could make a case what Bruno did in the Northeast for a babyface, but I don't think anybody can ever top what the Sheik was. I don't think you'll ever see anything ever like it again.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And I'm going to tell you, Bear, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to do a little self-editing here from now on, because we have some that are duplicitous. If anyone has mentioned one of the names before, I'm not going to bring it up again. So next on Pete's list, Ox Baker.
Yeah, and so what I like, and I thought about putting Ox on, the first time I ever saw Ox was probably the first time I was ever truly scared by a professional wrestler. And he was, I'll never forget it, it was at Miami High Lie, and he was wrestling Jack Briscoe, and he had Briscoe up against the ropes. And as he's got him up against the ropes, he's screaming at Briscoe and the ringside fans about how he's going to hurt somebody. And I was a kid, and I was just like, oh, my God, this guy is really scary. Unfortunately, if you saw Ox for 2 or 3 weeks, he was exposed at that point. He couldn't do a lot. His legs were, you know, his knees were non-existent, and he couldn't do a lot. But as a heel, that first impression was absolutely frightening.
Yeah. I saw Ox Baker at a television taping at the Davey Rodeo Arena in lovely Broward County, Florida. I want to say it was 87, oof, maybe 88.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because they were doing, I don't know if this was after or before the matches took place. He was doing an interview segment, and he was there, and he did this really strong heel interview. I'm going to kill you. I'll give you the heart punch. And the interview's over, and he walks away. And he was walking away like he was 105 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, his knees were just completely shot. So the illusion, you know, I mean, not that I had an illusion by that point in my career as a wrestling fan, but it just kind of struck me as funny how this guy who came off as so such a great heel and so devastating during the interview, once the cameras went off and he walked away, he really got exposed as just being this sort of crippled old man. It was really kind of sad to see. Next on Pete's list, Abdullah the Butcher.
Yeah, also there's another one for me right there. Abby would be my number two. And with Abby, I think it's a little different. I think, A, he never really had a run as a babyface. I know that he had a couple of matches here and there, but for the most part, he was a heel his entire career. And he drew money wherever he went. His matches were fairly predictable. If you do look at early Abdullah, he was tremendous. He could fly, you know, wasn't doing drop kicks, but his elbow was just out of control. And, you know, he was probably 100 pounds lighter than he became in later years, but he lived the gimmick. And even, I want to say it was in the early 90s when I finally found out that Abdullah could actually speak English. Because I remember he did that that interview on Japanese television.
I will never forget getting the Wrestling Observer when they did the book of wrestling biographies.
Yeah,
you know, like where he it was the Who's Who in wrestling, where he gave these little short bios and how good a worker they were or how bad they were, and it said Abdullah the Butcher, real name Larry Shreve.
Right.
I remember thinking, wait a minute, Abdullah the Butcher, the deadly killer from the Sudan, his name is Larry? That's right. My dad's name. You know? That just struck me as so funny. But I know what you're talking about.
lived and breathed the gimmick, and you just never. Maybe MJF might be the closest thing now because he's really taking that to the next level, where he doesn't let his guard down. He's MJF 24 hours a day, and that's what I always thought about Abdullah. So the first time that was on Japanese TV. And it was, I think he had a stogie and he was dressed up and he's speaking English. And I was like, what the fuck? Abdullah? What? So, yeah.
I always get a crack out of the fact that whenever he's not in the ring, the Japanese announcers would call him Mr. Abdullah the Butcher.
Yes. And he signs autographs, Jeff. And we saw him at that Wrestle Reunion show in Tampa in 2005. He signed a bunch of programs for me and he signs them Mr. Abdullah the Butcher.
Yeah. Okay. Last one for Pete here. One that you've discussed before as being one of the great heel turns in the history of Florida wrestling. And that's the Big Cat, Ernie Ladd.
Absolutely. Ernie Ladd. Again, it's when people give a shit about you, heel or babyface, they'll give a shit about you when you turn. And Ernie Ladd was so over as a babyface that when he finally turned on Dusty, he was the number one heel in the state automatically. So it was, it's almost like, I love you. You're my idol. And then when you turn, it's like, you motherfucker, I'm going to get you because I'm so mad at you because I cared about you. And that's exactly what it was. He was a great heel, but Ernie Ladd was a guy, and he's one of those that I think people would say he's one of the great heels, one of the best heels ever in professional wrestling, because so much of what he did was copied in later years. His interview style was unique to Ernie Ladd, but you can see little bits and pieces of it from people in subsequent years. So Ernie Ladd was great. He did some great stuff in the ring. Again, another guy who was just hampered by serious knee issues. Yeah. But Ernie Ladd's psychology of understanding the business meant he could be handicapped in the ring by those knees and still get over.
Yeah. And, if you see any YouTube matches with Ernie Ladd, that's, let's say, mid-70s, because there's stuff out there of like him and like Chicago and the WWA. Where his knees hadn't gone yet, where he is, for a guy his size, is utterly fantastic, Barry. And he really should be, when they talk about the great big men in the history of this business, guys like Ernie Ladd and Vader and Bruiser Brody, Stan Hansen, Ernie Ladd definitely belongs in that conversation because he was really, really good in the ring.
Yeah, he was really good in the ring. And unfortunately, you're right, too. As time went on, I remember watching Mid-South, I think around 82 or so. And you could just see, poor Ernie was just, his legs were shot. But you look at him in his heyday, and then there's the early footage that's out there too. I want to say late 60s, maybe early 70s. He looks fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. And you're reminded that he was a tremendous athlete. There's a reason that he was, playing at such a high level in the AFL. So, okay, now let's go to my good friend, Brother Jeff Steele. I reached out and asked him, give me your top five. He has a couple of repeats, including the aforementioned Ernie Ladd. But I will mention that he says his number one, two, one and two, Don Jardine, the Spoiler, a guy that appeared in Florida quite a bit, I'm sure, Barry.
Yep, absolutely. We saw him two or three runs. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's one of the great heels of all time. I don't know if he's top five. Yeah. I don't see it as a top five. But that's as a wrestler. He was light years above guys like the Sheik and Abdullah, in my opinion, as well. I would rather watch a Spoiler match over a Sheik and Abdullah match any day of the week.
Yeah. His next guy is number two on the list, a guy that when I first met Jeff, this was going back about 1986, and we were talking about guys that we grew up watching, guys that made us fans of the business. And he told me this was now 34 years ago. So apparently 34 years later, he still remembers this gimmick, not that it happened in 1986, but that's when he first told me about this, was the story of when Cowboy Bill Watts faced off with Waldo Von Erich, and Waldo Von Erich beat the Cowboy with his riding crop across the back. So his number two, Waldo Von Erich. Did Waldo ever run in Florida?
Never. So it's bizarre. I wonder what the reasoning was, and I don't know what it was. But Waldo, he may have wrestled one match in Tallahassee. Sometimes guys that were working Georgia, they would – because Tallahassee, not far from Georgia, they would come and work a Friday night in Tallahassee. And I think he may have done one shot, but that's it. He never had a run in Florida, which is bizarre.
Yeah. And the last guy I'm going to mention that Jeff pointed out, Mr. Unpredictable, the pride of Tampa, Dick Slater, Barry, a guy that, I don't need to ask you if he, because he's associated with Florida wrestling for so many years.
Yeah, absolutely, too. The pride of Robinson High School, a guy who was on the wrestling team, a guy that was on the football team, and he was a badass even in high school. Anybody that knew him in high school will tell you that he was a badass even back then. Yeah, Slater was, I don't know if he falls into the best top five heels in professional wrestling, but he was absolutely fantastic. He's one of my favorite wrestlers of all time as well.
Yeah. So next I'm going to go, I forgot to mention it in the opening part of this segment, but my friend Greg Good, the cable guy, who's been a wrestling fan since probably the 30s. Because
Methuselah, right,
yeah,
right.
Greg's an older guy. But yeah. So I ask him, and he says he starts off as number five is Brock Lesnar. He says Brock Lesnar is the closest to actually having old school heat that I've ever seen. Everyone else comes across as too scripted. The only heel I've seen in the past 10 years who has been seen as believable.
I cannot disagree with what he says. I think Brock is, I think what's happened now, and apparently he's done with the WWE, or so we're being led to believe, but I think he gets exposed when he's around too much. And I think that was part, everyone was complaining Brock's the champion, but he only wrestles, you know, 8 times a year or something like that. I think based off of who and what he was, they had to use him at a very limited basis, but he comes across as a real dick in real life. And I think that actually carries over to his character as well. So yeah, I like that. I like that inclusion a lot.
Yeah. And you know, I got to say that for the people that are upset about the fact that he only wrestles a limited schedule, see, to me, and I've discussed this before, that I think is part of the genius in booking a quote unquote world champion is having him not be on every week. That was one of the things that used to drive. Go ahead.
Yeah, but can I play devil's advocate with that?
Sure.
I agree with that. But when you've got pay-per-views taking place and your world champion is not even on a pay-per-view defending the title because he's only allowed to make 10 appearances per year, whatever the number was, which I don't remember, I think that actually devalues the championship a lot.
Well, see, my point would be, as an example, Okada, when he had the IWGP championship, I think he defended it over the course of a few years, like maybe 14 times. Now, he was on all their cards, you know, in right. a tag match or something like that, or where he wasn't defending it. And I think that was a really effective use of their world champion. And like Jumbo, when Jumbo was the champion for Baba's group, he wasn't defending the title on every single show. He was working 6-man tags. And, you know, now counter that with Flair, who was working just an incredible schedule, crisscrossing the country. And, you know, when you have Ric Flair, let's just use, I'll come up with a town, defending the title, the world's heavyweight championship in Homestead, you know,
happened. Yes.
At a high school gym or something.
Right.
To me, it kind of demeans the world championship. And, you know, I don't want to be like Lou Thesz where every match should be in a big building or against a big challenger. But, you know, I think when you have, much like you said, absence makes the heart grow fonder, you need to have them disappear for a little while and then, you know, show. And there's a reason why when Hogan was first breaking out nationally for Vince did not have him on every TV show.
No, there would be something there about Hogan, whether it was a video, there would be something that would keep him in the consciousness.
He wasn't wrestling every week.
But why he shouldn't be, I fully agree. But the whole Brock thing is weird, and I get I am agreeing with you. The only thing I'm saying is if you do have a pay-per-view, your champion needs to have a presence on a pay-per-view. He essentially is the cornerstone, the mantelpiece of your promotion, but there's been no build-up. He's nowhere to be seen. They don't even mention his name. He's not on television. I think that was kind of shoddy.
Yeah. Okay, so Greg's top three are three names very well associated with Florida wrestling, which, of course, Greg grew up watching, so not terribly surprising that he had these guys mentioned. His number one is a choice I think is very interesting and a guy that I really want to hear what you think of. But first, let's go number three, a guy that my friend John Hitchcock and the Carolinas has always mentioned to me as one of the great all-time heels and villains as far as getting a reaction from the crowd, and that's Johnny Valentine.
So I had Johnny Valentine on my list, and I scrapped Valentine. That was my seventh pick. And I'll tell you, so I'm going to say there's a couple of things when it comes to Valentine, and he's right. Johnny was never an effective baby face. And I think partly he was very, there was kind of this calm, psychotic demeanor to Johnny Valentine. And certainly when in the throes of a match, his facial expressions, he would get bug-eyed. He just looked like a lunatic, but he was methodical. And I remember my father saying to me, he said this about Lars Anderson years later, and I never knew that Johnny Valentine was the guy that responsible for booking Lars in Florida. And Lars had been patterned after Johnny. And I never realized the correlation between the two. But my dad said, this guy's legitimately dangerous. He goes, because what Valentine used to do, he used to pace back and forth in the ring. And I remember, you know, like we had seen all kinds of heels, crazy, outlandish heels, but you had a guy that was essentially stoned face, just pacing in the ring. And my dad saying, this guy is really psychotic. This is. And he really was. And you also look at Johnny's, what makes Johnny such a great heel? Johnny had a career that was something like 27 or 28 years. And when Johnny started, he essentially started within the first year he was on top. When his career ended, I believe he was 49 years old, he was on top. And how many more years would Johnny Valentine have gone being on top? He wasn't done. He would have gone into his mid-50s as a main event guy with no slowdown. So you've got a guy that's got this 26, 27-year career of main eventing primarily as a heel. Certainly in his earlier days, he was a babyface at times, but I think the longevity of being able to perform on top in main events for 25 years really says something.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, so legendarily, he was heard to have said that he can't make you believe that wrestling is real, but he can make you believe that he is real.
And that's right,
and that's,
Jeff.
Yeah, no, that's right. A sign of a great heel. So, Greg, number two, the great Malenko.
Yeah, the great Malenko, absolutely. So this is where I'm going to – is great Malenko. He probably is one of the greatest heels of all time. In Florida, he is recognized as the greatest heel to ever work the state. Kevin Sullivan might be – when I say that too, I'm talking about extended runs. Kevin Sullivan is probably number two. Terry Funk is in the mix, but Terry, his runs were always a little more limited than say, you know, Kevin or Malenko. Buddy Colt is also in this mix. But what the great Malenko did, great Malenko was the Roddy Piper to Eddie Graham's Hulk Hogan. You know, sure. It's exactly what happened. Eddie Graham and Malenko had a feud that was off and on for somewhere between 7 to 8 years that they were feuding. They had a match, Jeff. I want to say it was in Jacksonville. It was a Russian chain in a steel cage match, which just to me would have been the apex of
there may have wrestling. Been color in that match.
Yeah, there may have been. May have just been a little bit of blood. But, you know, Eddie Graham and obviously the relationship between Eddie and Malenko, which has been discussed, wasn't great outside of the ring. But at the same time, Eddie realized Malenko was the key to his success. You know, he owned the promotion. He and Luttrell owned the promotion. He could have brought anybody in. He had plenty of friends, especially from West Texas. He saw in Malenko what a lot of people saw. And I never got to see Malenko as a heel in his prime. I only saw him as a babyface in later years. And he was still good, but it wasn't what people in the 60s had seen. So I would agree with Greg. I think what hurts Malenko is as a heel, his career was pretty much done by the early 70s. I know he still worked in Knoxville. I saw him in Knoxville in 78. I know he spent some time down in the Carolinas. And then certainly with the split off, he went to All-Star and ICW. But I think if there was more footage of Malenko out there from his prime, I think that everybody might be saying what Greg just said.
Well, Greg apparently is going to respectfully disagree with you about the two best heels in the history of Florida being the Great Malenko and Kevin Sullivan, because the number one choice of my man Greg the Cable Guy Good, Barry Rose, is in fact the Missouri Mauler.
Did he really say that?
He said the Missouri Mauler was the most heel heat I've ever seen live. He told me a story. He said Mauler used to work the fans up so bad in Miami that they'd wait for him to come out to throw shit at him. One night after a match with Cyclone Negro, it was so bad the police had to use tear gas on the crowd. We hauled ass from the scene, though. We weren't near the small mob throwing shit.
So. Yeah, that would have been 69 or 70 right there. And I thought for sure Greg was going to say Bobby Shane, which
that would have been a great choice too.
Yeah, it would have. I think if Flaherty was in this conversation, I think Flaherty would have said that. I think Buddy Colt needs to be in that mix if we're talking. He is right about the Mauler. I never saw that era. I started going in late 71, middle of 71. I never saw that era where the Mauler was. I saw the Mauler when he came back in late 75. He was older. He had put on weight. But he did. He was he had a way of getting heat. A lot of it was this condescending, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm from St. Joe, Missouri, and if you're not, your opinion doesn't matter. And he was a badass. He also gave you this vibe of a guy that would take you out back behind the building and shoot you. Like you kind of picked this up. So I could see where Greg is coming from. And yeah, I can only wish I would have seen him in that same time frame that he did.
Okay, now we're going to a friend of the show, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud himself, ask Ron for his thoughts on this issue. I'm going to mention some of his choices that we haven't discussed yet. His number five, Fritz Von Erich.
Yeah, I think that's a great choice. I've only seen Fritz, as most people have, from his, you know, basically towards the end of his career and then into retirement. But we did have that match against Baba, and I remember we talked about it. And then we compared Walter to Fritz Von Erich, and Fritz was pretty scary in that match against Baba. Remember that?
Yeah, oh, yeah. He was laying those shots in, boy.
Yeah.
Let's see. Next, Bob.
Good mentions, choice.
Yeah. Bob Armstrong as a heel. And he has discussed in his tribute show that he did on the Studcast just how amazingly over Bob became, because the fans loved Bob so much that they couldn't believe that he had turned and become a bad guy. And now he did it for maybe a year or so. But he said during that year, he said Bob lived the gimmick. He wouldn't talk to the fans after the matches. They would come out there and say, oh, Bob, give me your autograph or take a picture of me. Get out of my way. And, you know, it was just, he said it was amazing how the fans, after Bob turned on Bob.
Yeah. And that, again, look, I've said it a couple times this episode, but yeah, if they're into you as a babyface and they love you, they're going to hate you as a heel. Absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah.
Okay. Ron's number two choice, a man we have discussed many times on the show, the Canadian Freight Train, Joe LeDuc.
Yeah, Joe LeDuc is, and I think Ron's got a great perspective. First off, he worked with these guys, so
sure,
yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, you know, look, that's going to beat our perspective, right? In a lot of ways, you know. But Joe LeDuc, the only thing I would say, when Joe LeDuc was on, such as that turn on Jimmy Garvin that we discussed in that epic three-part interview we did with Jimmy Garvin, that people still reach out to me, Jeff, and say,
yeah, you don't see reviews on iTunes about that episode,
right?
Do you? No,
yeah.
No.
People just fucking still, I swear, like, people will still reach out and just say, I listen to this. It's unbelievable. I think what hurt Joe was Joe never really went national as a heel. And we've talked about it. Joe going for Bob Backlund's title up in New York, in my opinion, then right now, Jeff, if that had happened, we'd be saying this is one of the top five heels in the business. Unfortunately, he didn't. He had a stunted run in Florida because of an injury right after he turned heel. And then he spent time in Memphis, and he spent time in Alabama in the Gulf Coast region, you know, and then other areas he worked as a babyface. By the time he made it to New York, I think, what were they calling him, the Butcher or something like that? But he was over the hill. He had gained a lot of weight. He wasn't the same guy. Joe LeDuc, as a heel in his prime on a national stage, we're saying one of the top heels of all time, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And the other guy that Ron mentioned, his number one, very similar, you know, as far as what you just said about Joe, you could also say about the Mongolian Stomper.
Yeah, you could too. Stomper is another guy that was kind of unusual and never again. I think he was in the AWA at the tail end of his career, but he was a guy. Everybody said the Stomper. He went to his own. He beat to, I don't know what the fucking saying is, to his own drum. He beat to his own fucking something like that. Don't put all your eggs in a basket. You know,
I don't know.
I don't know.
Linda Ronstadt. You and I marched to the beat of a different drum.
There you go. But he,
our first reference to Linda Ronstadt, I believe, on this podcast.
Yeah, I think it is. Boy, did I have a crush on her when we were both young.
Yeah, but you chose Susan Richards. Not Linda Ronstadt.
Had the door been opened for me, Jeff. You're right. That door was sealed fucking shut with 20 locks on it. So, but it's Stomper was a guy that I think could have done more in his career. And I think it was JJ's book, JJ or Gary Hart or both of their books. But I think it was JJ's where he said Stomper didn't make a lot of friends. He walked out of a lot of territories. He burned bridges. And that very well
could be the reason why he didn't get a national run.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. Because I think in his heyday, again, if you had taken Stomper, 72 through 77, which is probably prime years for him.
Mongolian Stomper versus Bruno in the Garden. How fantastic. Yeah,
absolutely. With a great mouthpiece, give him to the Grand Wizard or something. It would have drawn money. But I think there was this fear that, we couldn't work with this guy. And I think that's what also hurt Stomper, is not being on a national level. But to that point, I did see him in Hazard, Kentucky as well. And, even that was 78. Stomper, people hated him. He was absolutely a hated heel.
Okay. So now, Barry, let's get back. First of all, thank you to the gentleman that answered my questions. And
great choices. I still don't understand Bruce Mitchell's. Was he saying Baby Doll was one of the great heels?
I guess he's talking about from that night, the visceral reaction that she got from the fans.
All right.
Through all that.
Well, I can't argue because I wasn't there, but I somehow don't see on the upper, the upper pantheon of great heels in the mantelpiece. And this is not a knock on her, but the Sheik, Oxbaker, and Baby Doll. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, don't be criticizing Bruce Mitchell now, my friend. Okay. Now let's get back to our top three. Barry, tell me what your number three choice would have been. Somebody we've already mentioned. Feel free to discuss it.
So I'm going to – the Sheik and Abdullah were on my list. Somebody brought him up. Johnny Valentine was on my list. Two names. I mentioned Mad Dog Vachon and Gorgeous George. I've got two names left, Jeff, and I'm going to throw those two names at you. One was Fred Blassie. Now, I'm not talking the Hollywood fashion plate of the WWE. I'm talking the vampire. I'm talking the guy that apparently was giving people heart attacks in Japan and they were dying. The guy that was selling out Los Angeles for years, selling out Atlanta for years. A guy that was so limited in the ring, apparently was never leaving his feet, but yet he understanding the psychology of how to get a crowd invested into a match. I think he's one guy. And here's one for you,
wait,
Jeff.
Wait. Freddie Blassie, let's remember, used to file his teeth.
Yes.
Yeah,
he did.
Before he was go in the ring and start biting his opponents and get color. Okay, that now was, tell us.
It's a great photo app. That's it. I remember seeing that photo. So here's a name that we didn't mention. And when I think about it, he is what I think makes him a great heel is not only in professional wrestling through storylines is he a great heel, but I think he's equally hated in real life, and it's Vincent Kennedy McMahon.
Very good choice. No question about it.
Yeah. Hated by everybody, for the most part.
No, and let's be honest, because just like we said, Hulk Hogan needed Roddy Piper, Steve Austin needed Vince McMahon.
Absolutely.
And vice versa. There's no question about
it. It worked.
So, yeah. So I will now offer my my last three choices. We've discussed two of them. One we have not. One of them is Roddy Piper, and we discussed how, you know, we just mentioned Hulk Hogan needed Roddy Piper. I said that I did not want the whole importance of what he drew to be one of the key factors, but how can you not, because he was so important in the early history of the WWF. But again, also what he did in the Carolinas, what he did in Georgia, you know, the fact that just standing there, he started the program with guys like Bob Armstrong and Tommy Rich by making fun of Brad with Bob Armstrong. That was such great stuff that he did there. My number one choice, I'm gonna skip over my number two because that's somebody who has not yet been mentioned. My number one choice we've discussed was the Sheik. I think the Sheik was just, he's just on a different level from everybody else, you know, and the whole scariness factor. And in saying that, the only person that I ever saw when I saw this person with Dave Meltzer in Japan in December of 1987, he agreed with me when I said this. The only person that we've ever seen live in front of a crowd that caused the sort of reaction with a crowd that the Sheik did was Dump Masumoto. Dump Masumoto completely terrified. Now, understand, and I realize the audience that she was trying to get over with was 13 and 14 year old girls primarily. They were completely terrified of Dump Masumoto. And Dump Masumoto would come out there, and much like we said, Piper for Hogan, Austin for McMahon, Dump Masumoto's babyface foil was Chigusa Nagoyo. I will go to my grave believing that these two had one of the all-time great babyface heel confrontations. We actually had a chance many, many episodes ago to review one of their matches. Was it, you know, Kenta Kobashi versus Dr. Death? No, but it was a battle of good versus evil, which is, at its very basis form, what pro wrestling is supposed to be about. And under those auspices, Dump Masumoto definitely filled the bill there.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you can, so if you take into account Japan, the Japanese women, right? Between Dump and, yeah, oh my God, absolutely. That was at a different level. And that was partly at a different level because of their fan base, because their fan base was this grouping primarily of young females who were crying in the crowds, in the audience.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the stuff where Chigusa ends up having to have, no, mind you, this is a woman, gets her head shaved after she's lost a match to Dump. You should see the reaction of the crowd. They're absolutely losing their mind. Yep. So I do not want Dump Masumoto to be forgotten in this list of people that coming into the ring, coming towards the ring at ringside, her work with the referees where she would take the kendo sticks and the trash cans to the referees. She did not give a shit. That was part of her character. Was fantastic. I just want to point out as we begin to wrap up the show, that Lou was pointing out that getting back to your critique of Bruce Mitchell in his comments, that maybe Bruce was talking about Wahoo that night and the way that Wahoo was fighting with the crowd and getting over. And part of it was just that Baby Doll and Tully Blanchard was there. So maybe that gives him the benefit of the doubt.
But he said something about Baby Doll.
No, I'm sure you want to apologize to Bruce.
Just the opposite. I'm pointing out where he's talking about Baby Doll, like running and how she's not falling, which is why I thought, you know, why is he spending all this time on Baby Doll? It doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah.
I am going to have to reach out to Bruce Mitchell and get a clarification on this now. Thanks a lot, Barry. On behalf of my co-host, Barry Rose, and our producer, the sweet man, Lou Kippelman, back to being the sweet man, back to being the chef. We've forgone or forgotten about the other nickname because, quite frankly, nobody responded to me about the nickname that I gave him last week, so I guess it wasn't that big a deal. I would remind you that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We are on clean feed, so I hope the sound is a little better. And, Barry, I am going to mention one last thing as we get ready to go. Since we brought it up, I believe it was maybe a week or two ago, Justin Pratt. We discussed that Justin was the guy that was not sure whether or not he had lymphoma, like me, because he had some swollen lymph nodes. Justin sent me a note. Just an update. Looks like no lymphoma, just a growth in my tonsils that's causing the swelling. No cancer on Justin. Round of applause from the folks here at Breaking Kayfabe for you, Justin. Glad to hear that, my buddy. Yes, absolutely. Lou chiming in with some very rare hand clap from Lou there. So we appreciate that. Until next week, folks, appreciate you listening. And hey, go out there and write some positive reviews for us on iTunes as a way of telling those people to go fuck themselves. Have a good one, folks. We'll talk to you next week.